KNW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Votes are being cast in the presidential election. Early voting began yesterday in person in Virginia, South Dakota, and Minnesota. The state of Nebraska splits its electoral votes, and two sources confirmed to ABC that former President Trump spoke by phone to a Republican state senator as part of a bid to change the rules in the state to award all of its vote to the state's popular vote winner. There's also a change in Georgia. ABC's Perry Russum says ballots there require to be counted by hand.
The rule was passed yesterday by the state election board in Georgia. It's led by Republicans who Trump has supported, and the vote was 3-2 with all Republicans voting in favor. State officials are raising questions about the legality and whether it's even possible to count all the ballots by hand. The secretary of state in Georgia says this will increase the chance of error, stolen ballots, and fraud.
The former president back on the campaign trail today. He holds a rally in North Carolina. This is ABC News. The Federal Trade Commission is suing U.S. prescription drug middlemen, accusing them of inflating insulin prices, says ABC's Chuck Sievertson.
The FTC is suing the three largest drug pharmacy benefit managers, Caremark Rx, Express Scripts, and Optum Rx, which the agency says handle 80% of prescriptions in the U.S. The FTC says the company's focused on getting high rebates from drug makers instead of keeping costs low for consumers out of greed. More than 8 million Americans with diabetes rely on insulin.
All three companies dispute the allegations. Cigna says the FTC does not understand drug pricing. And as the investigation into Thursday's shooting death of a Kentucky judge, Kevin Mullins, killed in his chambers with a sheriff's deputy charged with his murder, 3 days before the shooting, that deputy was deposed in a federal lawsuit after a former inmate accused him of failing to train and supervise another deputy who sexually abused her in the judge's chamber. I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
My friends swim no matter the season, but my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis can sometimes take me out of the moment. Now, thanks to Skyrizi and clear skin, count me in. With Skyrizi, Risankizumab Riza, a prescription-only 150 milligram injection for adults who are candidates for systemic or phototherapy. 3 out of 4 people achieve 90% clear skin at 4 months.
Don't use if allergic to Skyrizi. Serious allergic reactions and an increased risk of infections or a lower ability to fight them may occur. Before treatment, your doctor should check for infection and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms, such as fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, or if you plan to or recently received a vaccine.
Thanks to Skyrizi, there's nothing on my skin, and that means everything. Ask your doctor today about Skyrizi, the number one dermatologist-prescribed biologic in psoriasis, and visit Skyrizi.com or call 1-866-SKYRIZI to learn more.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News. Your news in depth. Find it in the news section at WGBW.FM.
This is Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. In the last week, a bill to protect access to IVF failed on the Senate floor. Many families are scared that more restrictions on reproductive rights will impact their ability to have children. Mike Moen talks with one mom who says IVF was her lifeline.
For the second time this year, Senate Republicans blocked efforts to put in place a nationwide right to in vitro fertilization, or IVF. The outcome is likely to get more attention on the campaign trail this fall. Mariah Grant, a mother from Bloomington, says she and her husband were both diagnosed with infertility. They are now proud parents of a daughter through IVF, but there were many hoops to jump through.
Infertility is a disease, and like any other disease, it is emotionally and physically exhausting. When your disease is not covered by insurance, there's a financial component added on top of it, which is equally exhausting.
She says the couple underwent many tests, took out a second mortgage, and relied on crowdfunding to pay for the IVF. In Congress, Senate Republicans say they support IVF but accuse Democrats of a political stunt by bringing it to a vote. Democrats contend the outcome aligns with conservative ideals in curtailing reproductive freedoms. Grant says people have their right to their opinions about an issue, but those beliefs shouldn't come at the expense of access to reproductive care.
It's isolating. Our society has created a taboo around it for so long.
Although the U.S. Senate vote failed, Grant says it's encouraging to see policymakers debate this topic openly. Minnesota Governor and Democratic Vice Presidential nominee Tim Walz has frequently called for expanded access to IVF, citing his family's struggle with infertility. This is Mike Moen for Minnesota News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
More news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, sunshine and highs in the mid-80s. Mostly cloudy, low 60s tonight. Showers and thunderstorms are likely. For Sunday, showers and 69. Mostly sunny, 69 for Monday. Tuesday, mostly sunny, 71. 73 on Wednesday.
Currently, 66 degrees.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey, this is Aaron, Todd's producer. Next time, Todd's going to be back from Cheese Days in Monroe, and he's going to walk us through Vice President Harris' stop in Madison, as well as any other weekend news. Tune in.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2. The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus Law Review, and yes, my name is Jim Santel. Thank you for joining me in this, the second hour of our weekly weekend broadcast. We're going behind the scenes this broadcast to talk about some reliable, credible reporting about how it is that the Supreme Court issued these three major decisions of just this past year, finding first that the President of the United States of America is in fact immune from criminal prosecution for some varieties of crimes that he, maybe one day she, commits in office, finding also that Donald Trump needed to remain on the ballot in Colorado, and also interpreting this Fisher statute, Section 1512, in a way that's fairly narrow, and indicating that prosecutors had improperly used it when it comes to prosecuting the January 6th rioters, a case that also had implications for Donald Trump, and the case still pending against him because two of the counts against him in that federal election interference case are invoked under that particular statute. Major decisions of just this past summer, indicating once again, based upon the inside reporting, that John Roberts had a view from the start, way back in February, about how all of these cases should be decided, even before oral arguments. Again, nothing wrong with that necessarily, but it reveals a Chief Justice who was very strong and very headstrong in his decision that each one of these would be a victory, if you will, at least in terms of the legal principles for Donald Trump. Along the way, with respect to this decision about immunity, lots of conferencing, lots of back and forth about the timing of taking it up. Again, Justice Sotomayor protesting not only the decision, the apparent decision to reverse the lower court that had found that indeed there's no immunity at all. But beyond that, she said that the Supreme Court was being used to delay the trial. And she's very concerned about timing on all of this. And she went on to say that all of this would be subject, of course, to criticism by the American population when the Supreme Court decides to take the case and here's it in a schedule with which she was not in concurrence. Some of the most conservative members at the same time said they did not want to hear the case until the start of the next term. That is a term coming up, not even begun yet, in this coming October. Justice Thomas, for example, favored scheduling the arguments on this immunity issue in October. He told colleagues that he did not want to see the court dragged into political battles. Justice Gorsuch apparently agreed with Justice Thomas. The matter was too important to rush, he said. And lawyers on the case would need time to prepare their strongest arguments. And again, according to that schedule, which is not the one that was adopted, but nonetheless, according to that proposed schedule, the Supreme Court would not decide the immunity question until after the presidential contest is known in November. And of course, as we've discussed before, if Donald Trump wins, highly likely that criminal prosecution would go away upon his direction to the Department of Justice to have it dismissed. Now, the Chief Justice's position prevailed in the end on the immunity case, not only substantively finding that indeed there are these broad immunities, presumptive immunities, cases involving not just official conduct, but unofficial conduct, personal behaviors, all of those kinds of distinctions coming out of the Chief Justice's review and examination and articulation of exactly how this was to be done. He preferred to hear the case, of course, in the present term, which is exactly what happened April 25th. Justice Kavanaugh was amenable to that. Oral arguments were set. And again, we know what happened in the wake of that. During the course of that oral argument, stunningly, members of the Supreme Court indicating that indeed they had problems with the notion that immunities would not apply to the sitting or a former president. The justices had told the attorneys to argue this question, whether and if so, and what extent does a former president enjoy presidential immunity from criminal prosecution for conduct alleged to involve official acts during his tenure. That was apparently crafted by the Chief Justice and others as a way of focusing the entire case upon the immunity issue in a way that it had not previously been done. April 25th, that argument takes place. And during that argument, once again, several of those justices said that they wanted to focus not on what happened in the particular case, not on the allegations against Donald Trump, but on these broader legal questions, apparently that also designed in many ways by the Chief Justice. I'm not discussing the particular facts of this case. That's what Justice Sam Alito said. I'm not focused on the here and now of this case, Justice Kavanaugh had said. I'm very concerned about the future. Again, reflecting much of what the Chief Justice had also written about. And Justice Gorsuch saying, we're writing for the ages. All of that indicating, as they did, that they did not want to talk about Donald Trump's specific allegations, but nonetheless wanted to establish these very broad principles. That happening before and certainly during the course of the oral argument of April 25th. And right after that, they met in private, as they often do. Six conservative justices voted in favor of Donald Trump at the time, greatly expanding presidential immunity. There was not a lot of back and forth among that group, the majority of the time. The three liberals, of course, Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan, Ketanji Brown Jackson, voicing their strong opposition to that. They voted against that. The Chief Justice circulated a draft of this on June 1 in the wake of all of that. And Justice Sotomayor responded that she would consider a partial compromise and if, in fact, she could have some involvement in what that final opinion would say. That was pretty much rebuffed by the Chief Justice. And that left only one challenger in all this, as we've talked before, Amy Coney Barrett, departing company from the majority there on one of these issues having to do with what can and cannot be used to prove crimes in the trial. Justice Barrett, and again, articulating in what was sort of a dissent, even in the midst of her concurrence, that was also the subject of discussion among the Chief Justice and others after he filed his draft majority opinion. Amy Coney Barrett seemed skeptical as she read that, saying that she intended to vote with him, but would not join on three points. Now, we saw in the end it was just one, and that may have been the result of some further deliberation. All of this, of course, coming out once again of memorandums and other things from the Supreme Court. The Chief Justice hoping that as a result of the things that he was doing in these three cases, the Colorado case, the Fisher case, and yes, the immunity case, that he would be able to articulate these broader standards for history and extending protections to all occupants of the Oval Office, regardless of politics, policy, or party. That's what he wrote in the end, also a part of his pre-decision memorandums that he was circulating. In withering dissent, as we know, hair on fire dissent by Justice Sonia Sotomayor and also by Ketanji Brown Jackson, all of them writing the majority opinion was completely unfounded, was contrary to our Constitution, and basically gave Donald Trump all the immunities he wanted and more. It also, Sonia Sotomayor wrote, protected treasonous acts, transformed the presidency into a kingdom above the law, and ultimately caused her to fear for our democracy. All of that language, as we have reviewed it before on this broadcast, all of that coming out of these deliberations. All of that also hugely interesting, given now the task given to Tanya Chutkan. In the wake of all that deliberation, we know what the Supreme Court did, now giving this assignment to figure out the applicability of what the Supreme Court has done to that pending case. She has now had a hearing, we know of a couple of weeks ago, and she has now solicited from the parties, from Donald Trump's attorneys, and yes, initially from counsel for the government, statements of position on how that immunity decision, and presumably also along the way that Fisher decision should and must impact the trial that she's got now back in front of her. She has not ruled on all of that, but all of that, again, comes in the wake of this very interesting, fascinating reporting about the way in which we got to those opinions, the roles of these justices, and the surprising unanimity fairly soon after, if not before, the oral arguments led by Chief Justice John Roberts. This was not a justice who was attempting in any way to establish a consensus, just the opposite. Having this very strong view about the executive branch, he went full speed ahead and not only decided that that would be the case along with the other members of the majority, but wrote the opinions that described this very, very strong executive. All of that, again, a part of our history now, a behind-the-scenes history of the United States Supreme Court. We also know that the United States Supreme Court has been victimized in many ways by threats posed against them and other judges around the country. Threats, as we have talked before, have most regrettably, most illegally, most unconstitutionally, wildly undermining our system of rule of law. Threats against people with whom you disagree, whether you're judges, jurors, witnesses, members of the court system, those threats continue to come in to all people, it seems, who might be in the public domain making decisions that admittedly are controversial. And so just this past week, a 76-year-old convicted drug dealer from Alaska arrested and charged with threatening to kill, drown, torture, and lynch 6 Supreme Court justices and 2 of their family members. Again, threats coming from a man named Panos Anastasio. And Mr. Anastasio is accused of sending more than 465 threatening messages from March 10th of 2023 to July 16th of this year, just fairly recently, using the court's public website. He pleaded not guilty just this past week to 9 counts of making those threats against a federal judge and 13 counts of making threats in interstate commerce. If convicted of all of those counts, he could face up to 155 years in prison. According to the charges against him, the messages contain violent, racist, homophobic rhetoric, coupled with threats of assassination, again, via torture and hanging and firearms, encouraged others to participate in similar acts of violence. Now, as I said, this is regrettably this pattern in America in the early part of the 21st century, not unknown to us in other venues, has to be stopped, as many people have called upon for it to stop. In April, a Florida man was sentenced to 14 months in prison for leaving a threatening message for one of the Supreme Court justices. That person later identified as the Chief Justice. In June of 2022, a man from California, may recall, he was armed with a gun and a knife. He was arrested outside the Maryland home of Justice Brett Kavanaugh. In the past 2 months, there have been 2 apparent assassination attempts as well against former President Donald Trump and present candidate for the presidency as he goes forward with his campaign. All of this, as the Attorney General has also said, a strong and aggressive response by the Department of Justice investigating these threats, telling people that if they go down this road, they will be deterred not only by the prosecution of them individually, but also sending the larger deterrent message to those people who engage in threatening behavior against people with whom you do not agree, not a part of our American system, not a part of our constitutional premise. The Department of Justice saying you will be charged and you'll be convicted and you'll be sentenced to time in prison. As we continue, a little bit lighter story coming out of the Supreme Court having to do with books and things in your bookstore. Stay with us for that further discussion.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for the Todd Allball Show.
It's time to go for the green or gold with Civic Media's new Text to Win contest. When you go for the green or gold, you could win $100 cash, gold jewelry, and be entered to win our grand prize, 2 indoor club-level seats to see the green and gold in Green Bay. Download the free Civic Media app in the Google Play or App Store and get ready to text in for your chance to win in this statewide contest. Get ready to go for the greener gold with your local Civic Media radio station.
Out here in the middle of all these acres, it can feel like you're the only person on Earth. And sometimes That's how it feels when you're going through tough times. Trouble sleeping, your mind racing. So what do? We get help. There are people in our community who are here for us. Sometimes just talking to someone can make all the difference in the world. Find more information at loveyourmindtoday.org. That's loveyourmindtoday.org. Brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ad Council.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
My name is Jim Santel, and this is Amicus Law Review. This in our second hour of our weekend broadcast, talking about the Supreme Court, number of different issues on our docket for our weekend broadcast, talking about these threats that continue to be made against Supreme Court justices and others in public office. Something needs to be condemned and stopped in any way we can. Not a part of our American system, not a part of our tradition, and yet regrettably continues with respect not just for Supreme Court justices, but other judges who might run afoul of the views of some people who disagree with them. Nonetheless, instead of undertaking their First Amendment rights and articulating those disagreements, threatening horrifically violent conduct. And again, on the receiving end, as a result of that, of federal criminal charges against them. Also speaking this morning about this behind-the-scenes reporting about how we got these three major decisions of just this past summer coming out of the Supreme Court and the role that the Chief Justice played in orchestrating those results. On a somewhat lighter note, books coming out of the justices themselves. Now, if you've been to the United States Supreme Court building right there on Capitol Hill, not too far from the Capitol, very close to the Library of Congress there, you can visit there. There's a gift shop on the ground floor of the Supreme Court building, all kinds of knickknacks, mementos, other things. You can get gavels and paperweights, get Christmas ornaments and holiday paraphernalia, all kinds of things, neckties. The shop is dominated undeniably by books about the court, children's books, serious biographies, and some other things. But increasingly, some of those books include things written by the justices themselves, current sitting justices, and others who are no longer on the bench. And it seems almost quaint, if you will, come of the history here, that in 1988, then Chief Justice Warren Rehnquist fretted. He was anxious about a request from the Supreme Court Historical Society to sell a book that he wrote in the gift shop it operates at that court. He was concerned about whether that was improper or not. He said, thinking this through as best I can, it seems all right to me, but I shall be very much influenced by the views of any of those of you who would otherwise feel that I'm wrong in that. Rehnquist writing that to his colleagues at the time, indicating some vacillation, some uncertainty about the propriety of having your own books on sale right there in the gift shop of the Supreme Court. Of course, since that time, books have seen an even greater spread among the Supreme Court justices. Justice Clarence Thomas published a memoir in 2007. It's called My Grandfather's Son. He recounted his upbringing in rural Georgia. He received a reported $1.5 million advance from his publisher, and the book was a bestseller with some 237 copies sold. Justice Sonia Sotomayor received a reported $1.2 million advance for her 2013 memoir, My Beloved World, told about her youth in the Bronx and her rise through the legal profession. Book sold more than 320,000 print copies. That memoir, along with some other books, have included a young adult edition and several children's books, also earning about $3.7 million. Neil Gorsuch has been the lead author of two books since he joined the court in 2017. One of them is called A Republic, If You Can Keep It. The other one's called Overruled, The Human Toll of Too Much Law. Neither is a memoir in the traditional sense, but deals with judicial philosophy and the challenges for our legal system. The New York Times reports that those have sold about 64,000 print copies out there. Ketanji Brown Jackson, the latest to publish a memoir. It's called Lovely One. It's a personal account of her journey to become the first black female on the court. Came out earlier this month and has also launched a whirlwind publicity tour, taking her to concert halls and churches, television interviews and news anchors, late night shows, and the ladies of the view, if you will. She said, I wrote several sections from scratch myself because I really wanted it to reflect my authentic tone and views.
Two other members of the court have books in the works. Those are coming out. Justice Amy Coney Barrett joined the court in 2020, as you'll recall, received a reported $2 million. She reported on her financial disclosure that she had been paid $425,000 up to this point for a book that will presumably, not yet out, presumably touch on her large family and her tradition, her history with them, her career as a law professor before becoming a judge and then a justice. Brett Kavanaugh, also, who joined in 2018, has a book contract with an undisclosed advanced figure. He reported a $340,000 payment from his publisher on his 2023 financial disclosure form. And if books by active justices aren't enough to satiate your interest in all this, retired Justice Anthony Kennedy, who was pretty much at the ideological center of the court for many years, has a two-part autobiography that's slated for publication in 2026. Of course, a lot of this commenting upon not only what the Chief Justice and Associate Justices are doing in these areas, but what other justices have done. Not unusual. Other justices in the past have done this. Chief Justice John Marshall, for example, wrote a biography of George Washington. William O. Douglas, who was on the court from 1939 to 1975, 51 books on a range of topics that he authored. Others, of course, William Brennan, also the author of many books, some of them, not all of them, but some of them, available again in that bookstore and also in your local bookstores. And all of this, of course, at a time when the focus on justices and the source of income is a matter of public concern and public interest. Nothing ethically wrong, of course, with their writing those books, but disclosure is important so the American public knows where they're getting their money from and has an understanding of the sources of that money. Some concerns that some of them, especially with respect to a publisher of some of them named Penguin Random House. Penguin Random House has had some court actions before the Supreme Court. Concerns about that, if your publisher is also a party in front of you, those kinds of recusal issues also before the Supreme Court. Books in front of the American population, authored by justices of the Supreme Court, available again generally for purchase, but also for consumption. As we think about the role of Supreme Court justices, many of them related to memoirs, important to understanding who they are, and many others that focus upon their judicial philosophies also that give us insight, as we are doing in these 2 hours of Amicus, a law review, insights into what goes on inside our United States Supreme Court. Lots of things to talk about yet in this second hour of our broadcast, including sheriffs, including the role of sheriffs, the conduct of sheriffs here in Wisconsin and in other places. Let's begin that topic as well. We know from some reporting just this past week or so that Dodge County Sheriff Dale Schmidt has been engaging some clerks in his county to make decisions about whether or not they will have drop boxes coming up in the coming election. Schmidt, who again has publicly endorsed Donald Trump for president and Eric Hovde for U.S. Senate, apparently sent emails to the clerks in Ashapon and Hustisford and Beaver Dam on the evening of August 1, writing that he had heard that they planned to use drop boxes and raising concerns about their doing just that. He said that they were only the only clerks that he knew of in Dodge County that had considered using those drop boxes. He noted in the emails that while it was their right to do so, he strongly encouraged them not to use them as a part of their decision-making in that area. Now, we know well that all this comes from the Wisconsin Supreme Court not too long ago, making the decision that it is in the discretion of the clerks to make this decision. This past week, we know Dale Schmidt engaging in some advocacy with those clerks about what will and will not happen in those three cities. We'll talk more about sheriffs and the role of sheriffs in the elective system when Amicus, a law review, continues.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Matt Nair on Air.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Votes are being cast in the presidential election. Early voting began yesterday in person in Virginia, South Dakota, and Minnesota. The state of Nebraska splits its electoral votes, and two sources confirmed to ABC that former President Trump spoke by phone to a Republican state senator as part of a bid to change the rules in the state to award all of its vote to the state's popular vote winner. There's also a change in Georgia. ABC's Perry Russum says ballots there require to be counted by hand.
The rule was passed yesterday by the state election board in Georgia. It's led by Republicans who Trump has supported, and the vote was 3-2 with all Republicans voting in favor. State officials are raising questions about the legality and whether it's even possible to count all the ballots by hand. The secretary of state in Georgia says this will increase the chance of error, stolen ballots, and fraud.
The former president back on the campaign trail today. He holds a rally in North Carolina. This is ABC News.
This is your hometown radio, Refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
The Packers hit the road tomorrow. Hi, I'm Jimmy Cusco with sports, filling in for Mike Clemens. Green Bay is at Tennessee this week. In the preseason, the Packers traded with the Titans to bring in Malik Willis, who started last week's win over Indianapolis. Willis said that Tennessee knows what he can do.
I think I got paid the whole time I was there, bro. I'm more than blessed for the opportunity they've given me, and they brought me into this league, you know, whether those guys are there or not.
Head coach Matt LaFleur said he knows there's a tough task ahead for the offense regardless of who is at quarterback.
I think they got a lot of veteran players, and they're a well-built defense. I think schematically it's a challenge. Denard Wilson coming from Baltimore, and just he's an experienced guy in this league. And then when you couple that with really good players, you have a chance to be a really good defense.
Jordan Love is listed as questionable for tomorrow's game, which kicks off at noon. The Milwaukee Brewers lost Friday 7-4 to the Arizona Diamondbacks. The loss puts the Brewers 4 games back of the National League's best record. The same two teams play tonight in Milwaukee. Filling in for Mike Clemens, I'm Jimmy Cusco with Civic Media Sports.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, sunshine and highs in the mid-80s. Mostly cloudy, low 60s tonight. Showers and thunderstorms are likely. For Sunday, showers and 69. Mostly sunny, 69 for Monday. Tuesday, mostly sunny, 71. 73 on Wednesday.
It's 67 right now.
Wisconsin's volunteers are making a difference in our communities every single day. Find the perfect volunteer opportunities for you at volunteerwisconsin.org. You can filter by location, organization, cause, accessibility, and more, all to help find the best fit for you. Go to volunteerwisconsin.org or get in touch with your local United Way or Volunteer Center today. volunteerwisconsin.org is hosted by United Way of Wisconsin and Serve Wisconsin. Paid for by United Way of Wisconsin.
There are so many traditions built around the Wisconsin Badgers, game day and the mascot, which in 1889 was a real badger. It didn't go well. Eventually, the animal was replaced by a person. An on-campus contest chose the official mascot name, Buckingham U. Badger. Still, Wisconsin's official animal is a badger. But do you know which animal almost earned this title instead? Gray squirrel? White-tailed deer? Black bear? The answer is coming up. The original badger's nickname is actually associated with lead miners in the state, not the animals. It was the 1820s, and the miners often didn't have shelter in the winters, so they lived like badgers, digging tunnels into the hillsides where they worked. So was there almost another state animal? Yes, the white-tailed deer, which later became the official wildlife animal. But the history surrounding the badgers is a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Dom Salvia Show.
Thank you for tuning in. Got my friend Earl Ingram Jr., Civic Media's own. Earl, thanks for joining me and hanging out in Waukesha, man.
Man, you sound like you've done this before.
It's been a couple of times. I mean, not as old as veteran as you, perhaps, Earl.
The first time you're doing this under the Dominic Salvia Show, you've invited me. It's an honor.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app. John Mino and Jim Schmidt.
On Monday's show, we'll recap the Packers game in Tennessee, and Brittany Merlot joins us for the forecast.
And Grace Hageman joins us from the Kroc Center to talk about their Senior Life Expo. Join us.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. In this, the second hour of our weekly weekend broadcast, talking about sheriffs. Sheriffs in the state of Wisconsin, sheriffs in Ohio, and other places around our nation, focusing initially upon the recent engagement by Sheriff Dale Schmidt of Dodge County, right here in Wisconsin, reaching out to the clerks in Ashapon and Hustisford and Beaver Dam, telling them that while it's their right to make a decision about whether to use drop boxes in the upcoming election, based upon the Supreme Court decision of not too long ago, he said, "I strongly encourage you to avoid using a drop box." He said, "I struggle with the appearance of the potential for fraud, even if there's no fraud that's occurring. The appearance of fraud," he wrote, "can degrade our system, our trust in our system." He said, "Let me be clear. It is my intent to ensure every legitimate vote is counted and everyone who is legally permitted by law to vote has the opportunity to vote one time." Interestingly, again, this is coming from a sheriff reaching out to the people who've got to make the decision. That is the clerks themselves. Those are the people that the Supreme Court said are responsible for making the judgment call about whether to use them in their particular areas of responsibility. He required that each of the clerks answer 10 questions on whether they plan to use those drop boxes, where they would be located, and how they would be monitored. And among those, of course, is a town clerk, Beaver Dam town clerk, Amy Mallon, who initially told Schmidt that she had decided to use them. And that was, of course, in the wake of the Supreme Court decision. She said that many voters viewed them as more secure than the mail and wanted to see it come back. She said, "They trust that it is getting to me, that is the ballots getting to me securely on time, not potentially being tampered with in the mail." So she pushed back and she said, "No, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to use ballot these drop boxes for ballots." In the end, she reversed her decision after Schmidt responded that he was concerned that if Mallon used these drop boxes that were without requiring the ballots to come back to her office and physically hand them in, that that kind of thing would undermine the voting system, the voting process there in Beaver Dam. He recommended, again, not using a drop box and continuing to call those people who place their ballots in what is not a drop box there, but nonetheless kind of a drop box for utility bills and other things. He said that drop boxes are illegal, are legal, but that the clerks should not be using them because of his concern about the integrity for the election process and advocating then that these three clerks do not go down that road. He noted, of course, as to Mallon, that "I'm confident if you don't do it this way, it will snowball and be a bigger issue in future elections." Mallon responded that she had placed a sign on this box outside of the city headquarters there, asking people to return them to and deliver them to her in person. And Schmidt finally wrote to Mallon, said, "I think you made a wise decision," adding he appreciated her taking the time to evaluate his input. Again, a lot going on there, engaging with these three clerks, convincing them in the end not to use drop boxes because of his view as the sheriff that they would be compromising the integrity of the election. Question whether or not that is the role of a sheriff, especially when the responsibility is given to the clerks themselves. Certainly, councils and mayors and others in villages and towns and cities have roles to play in this. Question whether or not sheriffs have this role to play. We know as well that sheriffs becoming more political across the nation. Just this past week, an Ohio sheriff is also involved in a bit of a controversy in a place called Portage County in Ohio in the wake of his posting some things on social media, likening people in the U.S. illegally to human locusts. Human locusts. Portage County Sheriff Bruce Zukowski, who is in his own campaign there, posted a screenshot of a Fox News segment that criticized Democratic President Joe Biden and Vice President Harris over their immigration policies and the impact on small communities like Springfield, Ohio, where, of course, we have had this huge flurry of focus based upon things that have not, in fact, happened there. Anyway, Zukowski, who is the sheriff there in Portage County, wrote on his personal Facebook account and his campaign's account, he said this: "When people ask me what's going to happen if the flip-flopping laughing hyena wins, I say, write down the addresses of the people who had her signs in their yards. That way, again, this is the sheriff, Zukowski continued, when migrants need places to live, we'll already have the addresses of their new families who supported their arrival. Now, all of that, again, getting a lot of attention, a lot of controversy there, not just in Portage County, but throughout the state of Ohio. Many residents understanding that that post is a threat of governmental action to punish them for their expressed political beliefs. Many of them felt that they were being coerced to take down their signs or refrain from putting them up. A number of people objecting to what the sheriff there has done. And all of this, again, as a part of the politicization and the involvement of sheriffs in elective politics and in particular, the politics of this year. Now, Zukowski himself defended himself in a follow-up post saying he was exercising his own right to free speech. His comments, he said, may have been misinterpreted. He said voters can choose whomever they want for president, but then they have to accept the responsibility for their actions. All of that coming out of Ohio just this past week, and Portage County in particular, again, focusing very generally upon the role of sheriffs in the political process. Interestingly, the League of Women Voters, not a partisan group, did not respond well to this going on in Ohio. The group said that that the engagement, the work, these activities by Bruce Zukowski, the sheriff there, were contrary to their views on the Constitution. Two of the League's chapters in Portage County wrote that the actions there had left voters feeling abandoned and vulnerable. The League invited some time for residents to engage on this issue. We are calling on the secretary, Frank LaRose, who's the Secretary of State there in Ohio, to reassure voters of the integrity of the electoral process. All this, again, in the wake of Zukowski's postings. The president of the League of Women Voters of Kent said in an interview that the League has gotten reports that some people with Harris yard signs have been harassed since Zukowski's post went up. Again, what is the role of sheriffs as opposed to others in the appropriate political process going ahead? And finally, some general commentary about sheriffs very generally. And that is, again, without in any way suggesting that Wisconsin Sheriff Dale Schmidt or Ohio Sheriff Bruce Zukowski are members of this group. All of us know that there is a group called the Constitutional Sheriffs Movement, and they've got various groups out there in America. Some of them are called the Constitutional Sheriffs and Police Officers Association. There's the American Police Officers Alliance. There's a group called Protect America Now. There's the Sheriff Brigade of Pennsylvania, but especially this Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association advocating not only for a huge involvement of sheriffs in these kinds of things, but not just suggesting, but positing, but articulating the view that sheriffs do not, in fact, have to follow the law, that if they determine that the laws passed by legislatures are not constitutional, that they can choose to disregard it. And this Constitutional Sheriffs Movement poses a real threat to democracy. The movement gained an awful lot of attention in recent years. Adherents to it believe that the county sheriffs are the ultimate authority in our system in determining the constitutionality of the laws that they're responsible for enforcing, including laws, again, on voting, on immigration, on gun control, on health policy, a great number of things in addition to voting itself. The movement, of course, gained some attention in recent years after some self-proclaimed constitutional sheriffs refused to enforce government-enacted guidelines related to COVID, including those issued in the wake of the pandemic and other things related to mass shootings. Supporters of the constitutional sheriff ideology have also shared on their public posts some racist, anti-immigrant beliefs and have been accused of mistreatment of immigrant detainees, have been linked to anti-immigration groups like the Federation for American Immigration Reform, which the Southern Poverty Law Center has designated as a hate group. Supporters of this movement, again, the Constitutional Sheriffs Movement, have also, very troubling, been tied to the Oath Keepers Militia. We've talked a lot about their role on January 6th, several sheriffs appearing on leaked membership lists in 2022. Most prominent group promoting the ideology of this group, again, the Constitutional Sheriffs and Police Officers Association, founded in 2011 by a former sheriff named Richard Mack. He was in Arizona. He had previously served on the Oath Keepers board alongside of, yes, that's right, Stuart Rhodes, who was convicted recently, as you know, of seditious conspiracy for his role in that January 6th insurrection. Mack stepped down as the CEO of this group, and Sam Bushman, a far-right podcaster, assumed the role. This CSPOA, which the Anti-Defamation League describes as an anti-government extremist group, claims on its website, again, consistent with the overall views of this constitutional sheriff's movement, that the Constitution makes it clear that the power of the sheriff supersedes all other powers, including the powers of the president. And that, of course, is a theory that legal scholars and the rest of us know has no grounding in law whatsoever. But again, without indicating these recent events involving the Ohio sheriff and the Wisconsin sheriff are a product of that, nonetheless, we have seen sheriffs taking these positions around America that seem to articulate their view, wrong, legally unsupported, unconstitutional, that they do not have to follow the law if they determine it is, in fact, unconstitutional, that they don't have to enforce the law regardless of whether they whether it was properly passed or not. They're the ones who make those decisions, and in particular, maintaining that they have got ultimate authority when it comes to law enforcement, perhaps justifying some of these other events that we have seen recently just this past week by sheriffs becoming involved in the elective process and the political campaigns now underway. All of that coming out of our focus on sheriffs here on Amicus, a Law Review. We've got lots of other things to talk about as well in our remaining time here on our broadcast. Let's talk about some other things having to do with guns in America. In particular, let's focus upon something that the Ninth Circuit did just this past week, sort of a split decision when it comes to sensitive places and the use of guns in those places. California, according to what the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has just said, can in fact constitutionally enforce a ban on guns in so-called sensitive places when it comes to parks and playgrounds, bars and restaurants that serve alcohol, casinos, stadiums, amusement parks, zoos, libraries, museums, athletic facilities, and the parking areas associated with them. All of that ruling from a federal court, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, just this past week. However, it's also sort of a split decision. The reason why an awful lot of people on both sides of the gun firearm issue in America are claiming victory and defeat, depending upon how you look at this decision, undeniably a split decision, because the appeals court also went on to say that the state may not enforce similar restrictions in hospitals or other medical facilities, on public transit, at places of worship or financial institutions, or in the parking areas associated with or shared by those places. All that coming out again from a three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Court of Appeals, this panel went on to say it may not enforce its ban on guns at all events requiring a permit or on visitors carrying guns onto any private property where the owner has not posted signs explicitly allowing them. Now, this appellate panel, which has simultaneously issued some rulings related to like laws in Hawaii, issued its ruling in response to some broad injunctions, some stopping of this by lower federal courts, blocking the bans from taking effect until this litigation is over. The panel noted that some locations where it rejected statewide bans, like banks and churches, could still bar visitors from carrying guns based on existing property laws, but the state governments could not unilaterally, universally do so for them on their behalf. It said that owners of private property are similarly free to ban firearms on their property. Again, a very mixed articulation of this decision coming out of the Ninth Circuit, specifically finding that some places the ban can take place, sensitive places can be prohibited. So all of that coming out of the Ninth Circuit, and we'll continue to talk more about that as Amicus, a Law Review, continues here on Civic Media.
You're You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinair on Air with Jane Matinair. Weekdays 10 till noon on the Talk of Green Bay, 97.9 FM and 1590 AM WGBW. And on the Civic Media app.
Mino and the Mayor.
It happened this morning.
Again.
You guys walked in, yep. And I didn't notice, but right away Jim noticed you both were wearing shirts that were very similar. Jim had a salmon shirt on.
Yeah,
and yours is a little bit more to the red side.
A little more burgundy-ish.
Yep.
Rose.
Yep.
Rose, yeah.
And so Jim actually changed his shirt.
Yes. I'm like, I'm changing.
Mino and the Mayor, weekday morning 6 till 9 on 97.9 WGBW and 98.3 WISS.
It's easy to listen to your favorite local radio station anytime. Download the Civic Media app from the Apple or Google Play Store, then listen live or whenever you want from anywhere for free.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
This is Amicus, a law review. Thank you for joining me on this, our weekend broadcast, talking right now about a major decision issued by one of our Court of Appeals just this week, finding that, upholding, basically, California's gun bans in some sensitive places, but not others. Very much a split decision. The upshot of this, as Circuit Judge Susan Graber wrote, for the places where we hold the states likely may not prohibit the carry of firearms, the practical effect of our ruling is merely that private property owners may choose to allow the carry of firearms. Owners of hospitals, banks, and churches, for example, remain free to ban firearms at the locations. A very much split circuit on all this. Gavin Newsom, of course, who's the governor of California, claimed partial victory, said the state would continue fighting to drive down gun violence. This partial victory, this partial favorable decision from the Ninth Circuit, shows how far we've come, others have said, in government. But in this case, our work to restore the right to bear arms is far from over. That coming from the president of the Firearms Policy Coalition, who plainly also identifies this as a partial victory and a partial loss. And so that coming out of the Ninth Circuit just this past week, and in connection with guns and firearms, one more comment about firearms in America having to do with my focus this weekend on sheriffs. Just this past week, the sheriff of a rural eastern county walked into a courthouse on Thursday, shot and killed a district court judge in his chambers after an argument. Mickey Steins is his name. He's the sheriff of Letcher County, turned himself in after that shooting. And the shooting took the life of Judge Kevin Mullins, was charged with first-degree murder in the wake of that, Sheriff Steins was. And at a news conference on Thursday, the confirmation of that event happened. The shooting itself happened on Thursday at the Letcher County Courthouse, where presumably the judge, Kevin Mullins, was presiding. Sheriff taken to a local jail, been cooperative, according to authorities, with investigators in this. But the trooper who provided information about this saying, this community is small in nature and we're all in shock. Saying, as the governor has said as well, bemoaning the fact we've got too much gun violence out there. Governor Andy Beshear of Kentucky said on social media he was informed of the shooting. He says there is far too much violence in this world. I pray there is a path to a better tomorrow. That coming out of the governor himself and the attorney general of the state of Kentucky, saying his office would work with local officials to investigate and prosecute that case. Again, a sheriff in that county in eastern Kentucky killing a sitting judge there in that county. Again, a reference not only to focus on sheriffs in this broadcast, but also the role that guns continue to play in wreaking havoc on America. Beyond that, of course, there are other issues that have come up just this past week. We know in a number of different rule of law areas that Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski, who is a senator sitting in the United States Senate, she has thrown her support behind the impeachment of, yes, that's right, a district court judge in Alaska. His name is Joshua Kindred. He's a Trump appointee who resigned a number of months ago. And Murkowski has said that, yes, indeed, this particular judge should still be impeached to ensure that he can no longer sit at any time in the future in any sort of public role in American government. Kindred, who is a judge from the Alaska Federal District Court, did resign, in fact, way back in July. He was asked to do so voluntarily, and a counsel from the court said had found that he had engaged in a series of inappropriate sexual advances toward one of his law clerks. And the report described an unusually close relationship between Kindred and a law clerk of hers, and some denials of his initially, and finally some concessions that he did in fact have those inappropriate relationships. United States Senate very likely to take up the impeachment of this judge, even though he's no longer on the bench, as a part of its constitutional duties to respond and to provide oversight to the judiciary in America. Senator Murkowski, one of only seven Republicans who voted to convict Donald Trump, nonetheless now supporting the impeachment of this particular judge. She, again, advocating, again, based upon his presence and his role, his former role in her state, that she feels strongly that there should be zero tolerance for this kind of thing. She said that this is reprehensible behavior in our judicial system. Any workplace in this country cannot include that kind of conduct. Lisa Murkowski supporting the impeachment of a federal judge who is engaged plainly in misconduct while in office. A few other things coming out of the courts of our lands these days. A federal judge in the Northern District of Texas just this past week finding the National Labor Relations Board is unconstitutional in many ways because the administrative law judges at the NLRB have unconstitutional protections from being dismissed by the White House. That coming out of, once again, the Northern District of Texas. The NLRB prevented just this past week from moving forward with an unfair labor practices case against a social services tech company. Again, all that coming out of the district court finding the NLRB's authority there unconstitutional. And again, commenting in the wake of the post-Loper-Bright decision by the Supreme Court, doubting the legitimacy of federal agencies to do what they do. Yet another case, again, probably going to be the subject of an appeal to the circuit court, but a district court judge finding the NLRB cannot do what it has been doing for a long period of time in terms of supporting and advancing the labor rights and the union rights and other rights of workers in America. A couple of other things having to do with people in court. We know that Hunter Biden's cases, his sentencings in particular, have been delayed. Federal judge agreeing to push back his first criminal sentencing, now scheduling it for December 4th. The president's son already slated for a sentencing in that same month. These cases now going to be sentenced, subject to sentencing proceedings in Delaware. That's the gun case. And then in California, that's the tax case. Both of them coming up now in December of this year. The defendant here, Hunter Biden, again, found guilty in the first of those cases, the gun case in Delaware, and then pled guilty to the second case, both of them now being sentenced. Both cases, the subject of sentencing proceedings, two different jurisdictions on either coast in our nation, but in all now postponed until the month of December. And also coming out of the courts just this past week or so, some unfavorable news for Mark Meadows. His case in Arizona not going to be moved into federal court. A judge there denying that request. The case remains in Arizona. We will continue to monitor these and other cases here on Amicus Law Review. Thank you for joining me this week in our broadcast here on Civic Media.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, Mr. Global will be here to talk about gas and energy prices. Send in your questions to janesays@civicmedia.us.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
I learned patience from my adoptive dad. All he had to say was,
"Hey, you got this."
Just breathe. Hey. We're pretty good.
Yeah.
Might have to start a band.
I got it.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org to find out more. This message is brought to you by AdoptUS Kids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app. You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.